So after three chapters of Jesus' teaching, Matthew now gives us two chapters of Jesus performing miracles. We do encounter one or two other things going on in chapters 8 and 9, but that's basically what these chapters are. They're a large collection of healings and exorcisms and other supernatural phenomena. And in these first 17 verses of chapter 8, then, that we're looking at this morning, Matthew wastes no time in getting us into these miracles. These verses comprise three sections, as you can see from the way they're laid out in the ESV. And in the first section, then, verses 1 to 4, Jesus heals a man with leprosy. In the second section, verses 5 to 13, he heals a centurion's servant who is paralyzed. And then in the third section, verses 14 to 17, he heals Peter's mother-in-law who has a fever, along with an unspecified number of other sick and demon-oppressed folk. But while in terms of sheer space, the passage is clearly dominated by these miracles, it's important to notice that that's not quite the whole story, because in each of the three sections, there's also something extra, something not strictly necessary to the report of the miracle. So in the first section, the healing is done and dusted by the end of verse 3. But then there's verse 4, and this command of Jesus to the healed man about visiting the priest at the temple in Jerusalem. In the second section, if it were just a bare miracle report, then verse 13 would follow immediately after verse 9. That is, the centurion would put his case for Jesus to heal his servant from afar, and Jesus would then do it. But instead, in between verse 9 and verse 13, we have this interlude, three verses in which Jesus, for a moment, talks to those who are with him. And then in the third section, the healings are all over by the end of verse 16. But then there's verse 17 and this quotation from the Old Testament scriptures. And we need to ask then, why is the passage punctuated by these extra bits? And the answer is because Matthew is not simply reporting miracles. Of course, he is reporting miracles, but he's doing more than that. He's also using these miracle reports to teach us certain truths, and two truths in particular, I think. One that's closely related to the miracles, and one that's not. And it's on those two truths, then, highlighted by the extra bits in our passage, that we're going to focus this morning. And so notice, in the first place, we are being taught about an event. We are being taught about an event. So let's begin with the last of those extra bits that I mentioned just now, the quotation from the Old Testament scriptures that's there in verse 17. And so Matthew is saying that Jesus' healing ministry fulfilled a prophecy. Isaiah had spoken of the coming Messiah in these terms: he took our illnesses and bore our diseases. And Jesus then, in removing all these illnesses and diseases this evening in Capernaum, he fulfilled that prophecy. Now, if the quotation were from some obscure part of Isaiah, I think we would probably nod our heads approvingly and say, yes, Matthew, that's a really apt little prophecy that you've dug up there. Jesus does indeed fulfill it perfectly as he carries out his healing ministry. I think we would feel like that. But of course, the quotation isn't from some obscure part of Isaiah, is it? It's from the most famous chapter in the book of Isaiah, one of the most famous chapters in the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 53. It's the fourth verse of that great chapter, which means then that instead of nodding our heads and saying, yes, Matthew, we're perhaps more likely to shake our heads and say, no, Matthew, you've got this wrong. you're misusing Isaiah's prophecy. We're likely to react in that way for two reasons. Reason number one, we all know that Isaiah 53 is not about Jesus' healing ministry. It's about his sufferings. It isn't foretelling what Jesus would do in Capernaum in Matthew 8. It's foretelling what Jesus would do at Golgotha in Matthew 27. Isaiah 53 is about the cross. And then reason number two, precisely because the theme of Isaiah 53 is the cross, the illnesses and diseases that the prophet mentions there in verse 4 can't be actual physical maladies. He must be using physical sickness as a metaphor to describe sin. Because we all know sin is what Jesus was going to deal with at the cross, not illnesses and diseases. And so I'm saying then that for those two reasons, we may find Matthew's usage of this prophecy in connection with Jesus' healing ministry highly unsatisfactory. Well, let me address the two points briefly and in reverse order. So first of all, this idea that Isaiah 53 verse 4 can't refer to physical sickness because the chapter is all about the cross and the cross wasn't going to deal with physical sickness. That's incorrect. It's true, of course, that at the cross, Jesus was going to deal with sin. We're on absolutely incontrovertible ground there. At the cross, Jesus was going to deal with sin. But this is the thing. He was going to deal with sin comprehensively. Actually, when you study Isaiah 53, as many of you will have done, it's remarkable how many different aspects of sin the prophet mentions there. And he anticipates them all being dealt with through the Messiah's sufferings. He anticipates the guilt of sin being dealt with. The Messiah, he says, will cause many to be accounted righteous, verse 11. That's what we know as the doctrine of justification, isn't it? Being no longer guilty in the sight of God, but righteous in the sight of God. That, Isaiah says, will be a consequence of the suffering Messiah's work. Closely connected with that, Isaiah also anticipates the penalty of sin being dealt with. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities, verse 5. So that terrible divine crushing that awaits human beings on the day of judgment, the suffering Messiah will absorb and thus remove that on behalf of his people. Then again, Isaiah anticipates addiction to sin being dealt with. With his stripes, we are healed, verse 5 again. And at that point in the chapter, the healing in view is moral rather than physical. Because he continues, doesn't he? We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. So he's talking about that perverse urge, that depraved inclination in the human heart to do what is wrong. And through the suffering Messiah's work, that will be healed. But then, Isaiah also anticipates the wider effects of sin, as I'm going to call them, being dealt with. And that's the point in verse 4. That, you see, when sin entered the world there in the Garden of Eden, yes, it left human beings guilty before God. And yes, it left human beings liable to everlasting punishment. And yes, it left human beings with this deep-seated addiction to evil. It did all of that, but it also left them languishing miserably under a plethora of wider evils, things like illnesses and diseases that weren't part of human existence prior to sin. And Isaiah is saying there in verse 4 of chapter 53, that aspect too of sin is going to be put right. The wider effects will be removed. He's saying that one strand of the salvation that will flow from Calvary's cross is salvation from physical sickness. So I've dealt with one of our misgivings about Matthew's use of Isaiah here, but it still leaves the other one, that Matthew isn't quoting this verse in chapter 27 of his gospel when Jesus is hanging on the cross, but here in chapter 8 he's saying Jesus' healing ministry fulfilled the prophecy. How can that be so? Well, Matthew isn't really saying that Jesus' healing ministry is where Isaiah 53:4 is played out. He knows that will happen at the cross. But the point is that as Jesus went round healing people, as he healed people this evening in Capernaum, he was effectively saying, I'm the one who very soon will realize that prophecy in Isaiah 53:4. I'm the one who has come to remove even the wider effects of sin. And that's what I'm going to do when I hang on the cross in a few months or years' time. I am going to bear even illnesses and diseases away. That's what Jesus was saying when he healed people. And so that's why Matthew quotes the prophecy here and doesn't feel the need to reserve it for his passion narrative. And so I'm saying then, Matthew isn't misusing Isaiah's prophecy. My heading is, we are being taught about an event. What's the event then we're being taught about? We're being taught about the cross. Matthew is teaching us this striking truth, which I think often is overlooked and omitted in our books about the cross and in our hymns about the cross. He's teaching us that the cross deals with illness and disease. He's teaching us that the cross deals with physical sickness. And actually, it's not just in verse 17 that we're being taught that. One of the other extra bits that I mentioned in my introduction this morning is that command of Jesus to the healed leper in verse 4 about visiting the priest. Now, there are two interesting things there in verse 4. So first, there's Jesus' emphasis on the guy offering the gift that Moses commanded. That's what Jesus emphasizes. Now, we read earlier on, didn't we, from Leviticus 14, the relevant passage in the law of Moses, and we read all that Moses said has to be done when you've been healed of leprosy. And yet Jesus omits most of it, doesn't he? So he omits what was to be done with those two birds on day one of the whole process. And he omits the bathing and shaving of body hair that were to take place both on day one and day seven of the process. He omits all of that. And what he emphasizes here in our text is the gift that the healed person was to bring on day eight of the process. What was the gift? Well, it was this: on the eighth day, he shall take two male lambs without blemish and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish and a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil and one log of oil. And what was the purpose of that gift? Why did the healed person take that along to the priest? Well, did you notice that word that was used 3 or 4 times at the end of that passage I read in Leviticus? Atonement. 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 And you might think that's very strange. I mean, atonement makes sense in a context of guilt. But why does atonement make sense in a context of leprosy, in a context of physical disease? Well, it's this same point I made a moment ago, that in biblical thinking, you see, physical disease, like guilt, is a consequence of sin. In this sense, the entrance of sin into the world in Eden is the reason that there's physical disease. There would be no leprosy apart from sin. And really, you see, what that legislation then in Leviticus 14 was saying to the Israelites was this: the only way that leprosy and all other diseases like it will ever be truly dispelled from this world is through an atonement being made. An atonement that's better than lamb's blood. A proper, satisfactory atonement. That's what that legislation was saying. We know, don't we, all the sacrifices and the bitters, they're pointing forward to a better atonement. And it's true there in Leviticus 14. And so whenever a healed leper went along to the temple with his lambs to have them sacrificed, the whole arrangement was saying to him that if leprosy is really going to be dealt with, if disease is really going to be dealt with, an atonement, a proper atonement needs to be made. And that takes us to the second interesting thing in our text in verse 4 of Matthew 8. And it's those concluding words of verse 4, for a proof to them, or better, for a witness to them, a testimony to them. And I think the point is this. We read just now from, or earlier on rather, from Leviticus 14. I didn't take you into the lengthy depths of Leviticus 13. But if you read Leviticus 13, you find all these very fine distinctions between what does constitute leprosy and what doesn't constitute leprosy. Let me just read you a small extract. This is from verse 18 of Leviticus 13. If there is in the skin of one's body a boil and it heals, and in the place of the boil there comes a white swelling or a reddish white spot, then it shall be shown to the priest, and the priest shall look. And if it appears deeper than the skin and its hair has turned white, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a case of leprous disease that has broken out in the boil. But if the priest examines it and there is no white hair in it, and it is not deeper than the skin but has faded, then the priest shall shut him up for 7 days. And if it spreads in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a disease. But if the spot remains in one place and does not spread, it is a scar of the boil, and the priest shall pronounce him clean. And there's tons of that sort of stuff there in Leviticus 13. In other words, usually when a person went to see the priest claiming he should no longer be considered a leper, usually there would be something there on his skin that the priest had to look at. There would be some boil or blemish or something, and the priest would have to examine it and make this judgment according to the criteria of Leviticus 13, whether it is leprous, whether it's not leprous, whether the person has been healed, whether the person hasn't been healed. That would normally be the case. That's not going to be the case with this guy, is it, in Matthew 8? He's not going to go to the priest, and the priest is going to have to examine some blemish or boil on his skin and make a judgment on it. He's going to present to the priest a body that is free from any resemblance or vestige or trace of leprosy whatsoever. And that will astonish the temple personnel. They'll be blown away by that. And Jesus is saying, as they see your skin, and they see not some you know, possible healing there, but they see a clear-cut, absolutely definitive healing, that will be a witness to them that the one to whom all that legislation and the lamb's blood was pointing, the one who would atone for leprosy and disease in the fullest sense, the one who would be the answer to the problem of disease and illness in this world, he has come. He has come to make the definitive atonement, the atonement that will remove illness and disease altogether. That's what Jesus is saying. And so, I'm saying then that in this passage, it's at 2 points, we are being taught by Matthew an often neglected dimension of the cross. That the cross is the answer, not just to guilt, not just to hell, not just to the addictive tendencies to sin within us, but even to the effects of sin in things like illness and disease. Now, of course, there's an important caveat, isn't there, that we must always immediately introduce. And it's this, that this particular benefit secured by Jesus at the cross, it isn't experienced by his people until the last day. It's in those resurrection bodies that we've been considering recently in 1 Corinthians 15 that we'll experience that salvation from illness and disease which the cross achieved. Until that day comes, actually, we still can take our illnesses and diseases to Jesus, can't we? But we do so very much in the manner that this leper comes to Jesus here in our passage, and we say, Lord, if you will, you can heal me of this illness, this disease I have right now. I know you can do it, but it may be your will for the illness to remain for now. Not because you're heartless and uncaring, but because you may design to use this in me and to mature me and to strengthen me and to refine me through it. In this life, I'm saying that there's always that if that the leper uses here as he approaches Jesus. In this life, there's always that provisionality, that tentativeness. We can't demand or presume upon healing, can we, from our Lord Jesus in our illnesses and diseases in this life. That's an important caveat. But it doesn't detract from this main point that Matthew wants us to get hold of. Jesus at the cross dealt with illness and disease. And one day, we shall all experience that benefit achieved for us by Jesus at the cross. I mean, think about guilt. Think about guilt. And if you're a believer this morning whose conscience has been properly attuned to the gospel, then you know better than you know anything at all that your guilt is gone. You know that in biblical language, it has been cast into the depths of the ocean. It has been removed from you as far as the east is from the west. And it's this intuitive knowledge that you live with day by day. My guilt is gone. Simple as that. It's gone. It's gone forever. It's irrevocable. It's irrecoverable. It's gone. Through the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. Well, consider this. All those aches and pains and disabilities that presently trouble you, they will one day be as irrelevant and forgotten as your guilt already is this morning. On exactly the same basis, the cross of Jesus Christ, he dealt with both. He dealt with everything that flows from sin. And the cross of Jesus then will prove no less successful in the removal of your illnesses than it has proven in the removal of your guilt. There must be a resurrection body that knows no more restriction and immobility and pain and vulnerability, because Jesus at the cross bore away our illnesses. So get hold of this. Don't be embarrassed about this great biblical truth. Yes, understand the chronological caveat. Yes, understand that the health and wealth preachers are wrong. But understand that Jesus did bear illnesses away on the cross. He dealt with all aspects of sin, and one day we shall experience the complete package of salvation Jesus secured on Calvary. So that's the first thing this morning. We are being taught about an event, but then secondly, and much more briefly, we are being taught about an era. We are being taught about an era. And here then we turn just to that remaining extra bit that we haven't talked about yet, the one that's in verses 10 to 12. So this centurion, who is so prominent in the middle section of our passage, whose servant Jesus heals He is, of course, a Gentile. And in the midst then of this encounter with the Gentile centurion, Jesus in verse 11 makes this startling announcement that there are going to be loads of Gentiles like him in the kingdom of heaven. He has this beautiful imagery of this banquet, this great feast in the world to come. And there are the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But there too are many, he says, many from east and west, many Gentiles like this centurion. Now, through all the centuries then of human history up until this point, God's people had included very few Gentiles. There had been some exceptions, of course, there in the Old Testament period, but very few. And if then heaven, that world to come, is going to be filled with Gentiles, as Jesus is indicating here, presumably there was going to be an era within history when Gentiles would suddenly flood into the people of God. And indeed, throughout this gospel, Matthew indicates repeatedly that there is indeed going to be such an era, and the hints become stronger and stronger as the gospel progresses, until, of course, the gospel reaches that grand conclusion in chapter 28, where Jesus, about to ascend into heaven, sends his apostles into all the world to make disciples of the nations. In other words, this era is now. It's the era between Jesus' ascension and Jesus' return. The era when Gentiles like this centurion are being ingathered into the people of God, that era is now. And in this connection then, just three things to notice quickly as we close. First of all, An explanation. How can this be then? How can Gentiles become part of the people of God? Gentiles who lack the pedigree. Gentiles who aren't descendants of those men, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Gentiles who don't have the genealogical credentials. How can there be this era that Jesus is assuming here and that Matthew is building up to throughout his gospel? How can there be this era of many, many from north, east, south, and west flooding into the people of God? Well, there's a simple explanation, and it's this: membership of God's people isn't about pedigree. It isn't about ancestry. It isn't about genealogical credentials. Look what Jesus says of the centurion in verse 10. Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. That's the crucial word. Faith. That's what membership of God's people is about. Of course, it always has been, even during that period when God's people was predominantly made up of Jews. They alone were truly part of God's people then who had faith. Those who were just Jews and didn't have faith weren't truly part of God's people, as Paul will explain, won't he, in the letter to the Romans. And because faith is the crucial thing there, membership of God's people can be extended to non-Jews. It can be extended to Gentiles like this centurion. It can be extended to men and women and boys and girls like us who aren't physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Faith is the crucial requirement for being part of God's people. An explanation that leads us secondly to a sketch. Because in this paragraph of our passage, we also get a little sketch of what this faith is by which then one becomes a member of God's people. What does it look like? Well, two aspects come across. First of all, faith has a high view of Jesus. That's very clear here, isn't it? If this centurion is a man of faith, and Jesus says he is, then clearly one aspect of faith is a high view of Jesus, because this man has a high view of Jesus. It's astonishing, isn't it, what the man says. He says in verse 9 that I am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. So the man is saying that, I know what it is to order men around. And he's saying, you, Jesus, can order illness, paralysis in this case. You can order paralysis around in just the same way that I can order soldiers around. That's what the man is saying. It's a phenomenally high view of Jesus that he has. It reminds me somewhat of that opening paragraph of Hebrews with which we began our service this morning. That phrase that I use in our opening prayer, that Jesus is the one who upholds all things by the word of his power. This word of Jesus that controls every molecule in the cosmos. That's what the writer to the Hebrews is depicting. And this guy seems to understand something of that. That Jesus' word controls the cells of his servant's body. It's such an astonishing conception of Jesus that he has. And true faith, then, in the biblical sense, always has that high view of Jesus. It doesn't simply say Jesus was a good person. Jesus was a noble example to us all. Jesus was a brilliant teacher. No, true faith in the biblical sense says Jesus upholds the cosmos by the word of his power. His word controls every speck of this universe. But then, in this sketch that we have here of faith, we notice not only that it involves a high view of Jesus, we notice it involves a low view of self. Because in verse 8, we have the man saying, Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. And by the way, these things go together, don't they? And the low view of self flows from the high view of Jesus, does it not? And by the way, there's a great practical lesson for us as Christians, that if we're struggling with pride, one of the greatest things to do is simply to expose ourselves to the glory of Jesus Christ, because it's very difficult to feel proud when you go and immerse yourself in texts like Hebrews 1 and you see this colossal person who upholds the cosmos by his mere word. It's difficult then to walk away strutting and swaggering, having contemplated that. And here's this man, and he's a man of great social standing, and he's a man to whom many in society looked up. And you might think, well, it's awfully difficult for him, surely, to be humble and to have a low view of self. But he has a low view of self for this reason, because he has a high view of Jesus, and he realizes that Jesus is so vastly superior to him. And so the low view of self flows from the high view of Jesus. You see it with Peter, don't you? There in Luke 5, and Peter, remember, is kind of criticizing Jesus for trying to persist with the fishing exercise when he knows there are no fish in that water. But Jesus insists they fish, and sure enough, the net is so full it almost sinks the boats. And Peter is just awed by this Jesus. and awed by Jesus, what does he say? He says, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." The high view of Jesus he has in that moment brings with it the low view of himself. And so do you have this biblical faith? Do you have the highest view possible of Jesus? And thus do you have a corresponding low view of yourself? And so an explanation, a sketch, but then finally a warning. A warning, because Jesus doesn't just make the point that those without pedigree can be part of God's people through faith. He also makes the point, doesn't he, that those who don't have faith, even if they do have the pedigree, aren't part of God's people. Those tremendously solemn words, verse 12, the sons of the kingdom, talking about Jews who have the pedigree but don't have the faith, being thrown out into the outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And of course the warning then here is for the Jewish people, and they would have been standing there around Jesus as he said these words. But I just want to finish reminding you how Paul applies the same basic point, but to Gentiles in Romans 11. And in Romans 11, he writes this from verse 17. He talks about remember how he pictures the people of God as that tree, that olive tree. And he talks about the natural branches being the Jews, and how so many of those natural branches have been cut off, talking about the fact that most of the Jews had failed to believe in Jesus Messiah, and they've been rejected by God therefore. But he says this, if some of the branches were broken off and you, although a wild olive shoots, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree. In other words, you Roman Christians, many of you are Gentiles, you've been kind of brought into the people of God where they have been rejected. He says, verse 18, don't be arrogant towards the natural branches. If you are, he says, remember it is not you who supports the root, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. And he says this, they were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. If God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. And Paul seems to be indicating there then that just as there could be and was this self-delusion among so many Jews that they were fine, they were part of God's people because they were circumcised, because they were descendants of Abraham, all the rest of it, even though they didn't have true faith. Paul seems to be saying that there can be self-delusion amongst Gentiles too. And they can think that because perhaps they're associated with an evangelical church, because they've been baptized, because they have Christian parents, because they are diligent in attending on a Sunday, that they're fine, even though they don't have true saving faith. And so we all need to examine ourselves this morning, and we all need to make sure that we have true saving faith, that we're not deluding ourselves on the basis of irrelevant things, but that we can say with the hymn writer, I will not boast in anything, no gifts, no power, no wisdom, but I will boast in Jesus Christ, his death and resurrection. Amen.